This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join us for a visit with H.K. Roy, the author of a new book, American Spy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, story of American Spy. You were a spy. That was your life, your career.
Yes, I was a CIA operations officer, staff officer for 13 years, and then after I resigned, I continued to support the agency from the outside for about another 13 years.
And you still have some ties in Iraq, right?
That's right. I run a business in Iraq and have been doing so since May 2003.
So no fear?
None that I can admit to.
Interesting. Can you give us an allusion as to what your business is, what realm it operates in?
Unfortunately, I really can't do that because it's still operating there. I do talk about the business in the book and how it came about and the fact that we supported the mission in Iraq for many years, at least until the troops were pulled out at the end of 2011 period.
And did you spend time in Iraq, Desert Storm, and afterward?
No, my first trip to Iraq was in May of 2003, right after the war was declared over, which it obviously wasn't. I teamed up with an Iraqi partner, and I describe how I met him in the book as well. And he took me and two volunteers from Amman, Jordan, to Baghdad to set up the business. And eventually, my former employer got wind of my business and asked if I would be willing to help them with their counterterrorism mission. And of course, I said yes. And we had a very successful program for many years until the troops left.
Let's reel back in time. Where did you grow up as a kid?
I grew up in the American Southwest. Again, they asked that I not get too specific.
And that's the CIA that asked you not to get specific.
Right. In fact, my book was cleared by them, so I had to make sure that I didn't inadvertently reveal any classified information. Mm-hmm. And so everything has been cleared. I grew up in the Southwest and then moved to Washington, D.C. for law school when I was 21, mm-hmm. Took the D.C. bar, and then I joined the CIA after that.
And what intrigued you? Why did you decide to join the CIA?
Well, as I mentioned in the book, I decided after going to law school I really didn't want to work as a lawyer in a law firm. I'd always liked foreign travel and foreign languages. I grew up going to Mexico. I was involved in things which in retrospect maybe helped me in my career. I would smuggle explosives and knives from Mexico into the U.S. in the seventh grade under my parents' car seats and then mark them up for resale to my classmates. Did a number of other fun things. But in the end, I just decided I wanted to live and work overseas and have somebody else pay for it, and it seemed like a good way to go.
Is a jurisprudence degree a requisite to be a CIA officer?
No, not at all. In fact, generally speaking, as long as you have a college degree in anything, you can go on to become a CIA officer. But it did help me because it teaches you a certain way of thinking and analyzing problems and arguing your point of view. And so the law degree definitely helped, but it's by no means a requirement.
We all grew up with the CIA, FBI, you know, all as a part of that matrix of our society and culture. What is the CIA? What's their primary mission?
The CIA's primary mission is to collect foreign intelligence in response to requirements or questions that are put to the CIA by policymakers. Information that is not publicly available through open sources, for example. So that means 99% of the information out there the CIA doesn't care about. It focuses on the secret information, which is responsive to what the policymakers want to know. So if the president or the Pentagon or the State Department want to know what Kim Jong-un's plans are in the coming months, that's the type of thing that the CIA focuses on.
I grew up similar era to you, and maybe a little bit of it is social conditioning or whatever, but I always believed and thought it was true that the CIA was above the fray of politics. Even if you as an agent were a Democrat or a Republican. You put that aside for this greater good for the country. Is that naive observation, or would you agree with me that that has been the bottom line operative of CIA agents and the agency?
That's completely true. It's apolitical. I couldn't tell you if my colleagues, former colleagues, were Democrats or Republicans. Politics never entered into our job. I know it's the same with the FBI and with the military. Obviously, everybody has their own personal beliefs, but those never entered the job in my experience. You know, we worked for whoever was president. I joined under Reagan, worked for Bush as well and for Clinton, and then after I left, for another Bush and for Obama. So we work for whoever's in charge.
So in your world, when there was regime change, it really didn't change your operation?
Not at all. Now, it may change the focus of what the administration is interested in. Obviously, the second George Bush was interested in Iraq, for example, and I get into that in the book as well. But we do our jobs regardless of who is in charge. Our loyalty is to the nation and to the Constitution. We take an oath, and that is not to any particular political party or individual, is to our country.
So today, for the first time in my life, I sense this palpable fear of the compromising politically of the CIA. Is that a fair observation?
Yes, I think I share that fear, and a lot of people do. The CIA and the Bureau and the military cannot be effective if it's politicized or ignored or slandered, and so that's kind of a discouraging trend right now.
Is there anything to protect that sanctity?
I don't know. I hear that people inside say, just keep doing your job. Don't worry about, you know, the noise on the outside. There's nothing we can do about it. We just focus on the mission, and we will hopefully all survive this.
It's interesting because implicit in the CIA's mission, there are times when you have to almost go above and beyond or sideways, lateral, relative to the law. And that's what caused that blowback when George Bush Sr. was head of the CIA. Remember the Church Committee, I think it was, that saw some rogues or whatever within the CIA and wanted to reel them in, which I understood, but it's an ugly business. Therefore, you can't open up the daylight too much.
Right, and that was a little bit before my time, but I do know that, you know, the CIA, like any government agency, must follow the law. And so when there is wrongdoing, it's appropriate for it to be called out. Obviously, there's a question about what's wrongdoing. You know, during the after 9/11, the whole enhanced interrogation technique, is it torture, is it not, is it useful, is it not? A lot of people still debate that.
If I remember correctly, it'd be fair to call you, your expertise, human intel, correct?
Yes, a case officer, an operations officer, focuses on human intelligence. We call it HUMIN, identifying, recruiting human sources of information to provide intelligence.
I've been friends with a couple CIA officers who did the same thing you did. Their expertise was befriending people in a bar or whatever in Afghanistan, wherever it was. And like, wow, you know, you're this Anglo in this foreign culture, and you have to gain the trust of these people and friend them. Which you did. Kosovo, give us an example of your time there.
Well, I spent a couple of years in Belgrade at the end of the Cold War and the start of their Civil War, during which time I covered Kosovo as well. At that time, we were running what's called denied area operations. And as I discuss in the book, I had a senior member of the Yugoslav Security Service who was my agent, and running denied area operations is a lot different than running operations in, let's say, Latin America. You know, if you're in the former Soviet Union or one of the communist countries in that time, you would be under surveillance a lot of the time. You might only meet your agent once every 2 months, as opposed to, let's say, Latin America, where you may have 15 agent meetings a week. And so you have to take a lot more security precautions. You really have to know if you're under surveillance, and there's specialized surveillance training that you take before going to a denied area, in addition to the normal surveillance training that every CIA officer receives.
And the Iranians surveilled you and almost took you out.
Right. So that was in Sarajevo in 1995. At that time, the war in Bosnia had been raging for about 3 years, and the U.S. had not been involved, at least not in a good way. If anything, we made the situation worse through our policies, both Bush and Clinton, by the way.
And you tried to raise a red flag, didn't you?
Right. Well, the first red flag was we just reported solid intelligence, which both the Bush and Clinton administrations ignored because they had good intentions, but they ignored intelligence and made bad decisions.
And was Baker involved?
Yes, yeah. He was involved with Bush. He was a Secretary of State, and essentially the Bush administration insisted on recognizing only a single unified Yugoslavia, which was a nice thought.
Concept.
Yeah, if it had worked. But the fact was there was no more Yugoslavia. It was falling apart.
And you guys on the ground knew that and sensed that and tried to warn them.
Yes, and we reported it repeatedly, and not just us in the field, but the CIA as an institution did. They ignored it, and of course the place fell apart violently, as we said it would. Then after the war in Croatia, the war in Bosnia began in about 1992. By 1995, I was told that it was actually First Lady Hillary Clinton who decided we needed a CIA station in Sarajevo, which we'd never had before, because chances were NATO was going to go in and get involved in the fall of 1995. And so I was dispatched to go and establish an official relationship with the Bosnian Security Service, which we'd never had before, in order to collect intelligence on the wartime situation there. Now, a war was raging, and so there were no U.S. troops there, and so it was tough to get in. But I describe how I did that in the book.
And that was where the professor that became a general, that's right? Yeah?
Well, that was back in Croatia, right?
Yes. That's a great story. You did such a great job of describing how he looked. What a disconnect.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes the people in charge are not what you would imagine them to look like.
So he was like a rumpled philosophy professor looking in a general's uniform.
Exactly. And in Eastern Europe in those days, that's typically what you found. A lot of the people who became politicians or generals had an interesting, you know, more literary backgrounds, let's say.
And you created a trust and a relationship with him, didn't you?
Right. Now, that was jumping back to Croatia. I established the relationship with their intelligence service as well. And they were very welcoming and happy to have this relationship, and it was very beneficial for both sides. When I got to Bosnia, however, while they were happy to provide intelligence on the Serbs because they wanted us to go in and bomb them, and they were being threatened and killed and slaughtered by the Serbs every day, at the time they were under the control of the Iranian intelligence service, which we didn't know at the time. And that came about in part because we had ignored the Bosnian slaughter for 3 years. The Iranians said, hey, well, go in and take advantage of this chaos and the situation to help our fellow Muslims. That was the guys anyway. And they eventually controlled the entire Bosnian Interior Ministry and Intelligence Service, unbeknownst to us. So I showed up and declared myself in true name as a CIA officer, which is what you do when you establish this type of a relationship, which is contrary to your entire, you know, previous career and training, and said, hey, I'm here from the government and I'm here to help. And shortly after I arrived, I would go to meetings every day at this interior ministry. And in most countries, the interior ministry has nothing to do with national parks. They control the secret police. And one day he called me into a downstairs office, and he was in there with a Middle Eastern-looking guy, is how I would describe him, who was also in camouflage fatigues. And then he sent me out of the room. It was kind of an odd situation, but I didn't think too much of it. I shortly thereafter found out that the person I was showcased to was the head of the Iranian intelligence service in Sarajevo, and he had a plan approved by Tehran to kidnap me and do other nasty things to me before likely killing me, as they had done to my predecessor, or my colleague named William Buckley in Beirut in the early 1980s. It was Hezbollah, but controlled by Iran. And since I essentially showed up on their turf, I was a target of opportunity, and they decided to take advantage of it. Fortunately, I found out about it and was able to get out, and that's chapter one.
You had to literally sneak out of the country.
Yes, it's hard enough to sneak out under normal wartime conditions because we had to cross Serb lines and they could kill us. But then I also had the Iranians and their Bosnian allies after me as well. Yeah, that's chapter one, and I thought that was a nice way to kick off the book.
Yeah, you kept going.
You have to keep going.
And then you spent time in Central America, Nicaragua.
I was in Latin America, and they asked that I not tell which country I was in. This was in the late 80s. I worked a lot on the Nicaragua war, although I wasn't assigned to Nicaragua.
So you weren't in Manila?
No, yeah. I was elsewhere, but I ran a unilateral agent from the outside. Again, Managua was a denied area at the time as well. In other words, a CIA officer inside Managua would likely attract a lot of surveillance. And so an agent who I ran would come, he would leave Nicaragua every few months, come outside and provide reporting to me on the outside. And then we also trained him in something called an RS-804. It was a way to transmit via radio satellite reports from inside Nicaragua. And there's a story about how we had to sneak this spy gear into him inside Managua without it coming to anyone's attention. And that's it's in the book.
Very cool. And a little bit more about your book. Again, it's called American Spy, H.K. Roy.
Right. It's essentially a memoir of my time in the CIA, both inside and working for them from the outside, like in Iraq. A number of stories happened after I left. For example, after I left, I was focused on Eastern and Central Europe and the former Soviet Union. I've essentially continued to run intelligence operations, but for private clients, corporate customers, that type of thing. I had good sources inside the Czech Republic, the Czech Intelligence Service. If you may recall that one of the justifications for going to war with Iraq after 9/11, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, was this weird report that Saddam's intelligence service had met with Al-Qaeda in Prague. And so the CIA asked me to look into that since they knew I had really good sources there. They obviously had their own sources, but you know, when you're talking about possibly going to war, you want to make sure you have multiple sources of information. And so I did investigate that with my Czech intelligence service sources, who reported conclusively that there was no such meeting in Prague. It never happened. And so that justification was shot down.
But you filed that report and it was totally ignored.
I don't know that it was totally ignored. In fact, after I did submit that report, they seemed to tone down the talk about this alleged meeting, which we now know never took place. So they downplayed it, although I think certain people who were really pushing for the war, like Cheney, probably continued to play it up, but it was totally false.
And what was Cheney's motivation? Why was he so gung-ho for war?
You know, I don't really know.
Halliburton?
That's one theory, and they're still in Iraq. Maybe it was just they felt that they didn't finish the job the first time around when they could have gotten rid of Saddam, but they didn't.
Let me ask you a what if. Might it have been better to have left Saddam Hussein alive and in power and to control him versus what happened? And you talk about this in the book, the deconstruction of the Ba'athist Party and the military. Anybody with a brain knew that was an insane thing to do. Talk about that for a moment.
Right. Well, you know, here we are 16 years after the war, and a lot of Iraqis are grateful that Saddam is gone, because in some way, I was just in Baghdad in April, and things were really pretty nice, you know. That was the best I'd ever seen it.
But right after you left, it started unraveling.
Right. In fact, in the epilogue of my book, I talk about the trip and how, while things look good, corruption is likely a bigger threat to Iraq than ISIS even, and now we're seeing these demonstrations and, you know, the Iraqi government responds to peaceful demonstrations with bullets, and they've killed, I think, several hundred people in the past month or two. So, yeah, whether we could have made a deal with Saddam, I personally believe that, you know, Iraq was not a threat to America's national security. They had nothing to do with 9/11. And as bad a guy as Saddam was, no question about that, it was wrong to go to war there. We could have certainly cut some sort of a deal with him. He essentially worked with us and for us before, when during the Iran-Iraq war, for example. I think the reason he wouldn't admit to not having chemical weapons was because he was the only guy standing up to Iran, and he wanted the Iranians to believe that he had these weapons, even though he didn't. And so that's why he wouldn't come clean, and I don't think he believed we were actually going to invade.
In a sense, Saddam Hussein was a balancing factor in that area relative to Iran.
Absolutely. He was, in fact, the only thing standing up to Iran, which, you know, most Americans and most American policymakers, whether Democrat or Republican, recognize the threat of the Iranian regime. And essentially, by removing Saddam, we did what Iran could never do on their own. And so it was a huge favor to Iran. There's lots of Iranian influence in Iraq today, although the good news is it's not as bad as some people feared. You know, Iraq is it's a Shiite country, but I would say most Iraqi Shiites do not want to be controlled by Iran. So that's the good news.
One of the other disconnects going reeling back in time, a mutual friend of ours who was Iran's scholar and we think CIA at points, I think he did a white paper about this, is when they sent Brenner over to do the voting for mayor or whatever. And he's going, you know, this is a warlord-driven society, and you have to cut a deal with the local warlord. They don't even understand the concept of community voting.
Yeah, I'm no expert on that. Iraq is very tribal in the sense that, you know, I went in with a Sunni tribal chief, and the tribe has been around for thousands of years, and they'll be around for thousands of years more. And so that is very, very important in Iraq. Again, some more good news from the war. Young Iraqis are becoming more Americanized, and they care less about tribalism. So, you know, they're evolving. And so, the good news is the young people kind of want to get out from underneath that. And that's what a lot of these protests are about. But it's going to be a huge struggle. And it's hard to predict where it's going to go.
Are there shades of the Arab Spring?
You know, I guess so. And right now, what's nice to see is that the protests are purely about corruption. It's not whether you're Shiite or Sunni. It's not tribal. They just want, you know, Iraq is sitting on, the government's sitting on top of all this oil. They have all this money. And yet the power still doesn't work. And there's garbage in the streets. And people don't have jobs. And there's so much corruption at every level of the government. I mean, from the lowest guy to the highest guy. You can't do anything in Iraq without paying a bribe.
So it makes your time in Mexico a piece of cake.
Right. And Mexico is strictly for fun. I don't do any work there.
You have a safe house there where you go hang out, right?
I call it the safe house, right. It's just
your little casa de safe house.
That's right. I've been going there to Mexico since I was about 8 years old. It's my second home.
In your book, you talk about the process of training to become a certified CIA agent. And that was kind of an adventure in its own right for you.
Yes, that was really a lot of fun, especially after being cooped up in law school for 3 years, to be able to go to a secret base in the woods and have paramilitary training for several months. For those of us who had no military experience, that was kind of nice to get that without having to actually join the military.
Your instructors were Green Beret dudes. That they made your life brutal. You probably ate bugs when you were lucky.
We did. So a lot of the trainers in the paramilitary course were Vietnam vets or who had worked with CIA. Typically, they had both CIA and military background. So a lot of our training was based on the Vietnam experience. We went through what's called SEER training, S-E-R-E, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, which is training given to high-risk Americans overseas, like pilots who might be captured, or in this case, CIA officers. It was brutal, but it was really valuable. You know, you spend time out in the woods, and then you're picked up. You're out in the woods training guerrilla forces, essentially. A lot of our training was focused on counterinsurgency, and it was kind of like ISIS training, but without the beheadings and without Facebook.
Everything but. And one of the memorable moments for me reading your book had to do with your paratrooper training and why they gave you these brutal chutes that about drove your legs in the ground.
Right. Parachute training was purely voluntary, and most of us did it because, once again, we couldn't believe they actually paid us to do this. But it was run by the U.S. Army, and it was basic Army airborne training. And in those days,
were you at Fort Benning? Where did you do that?
No, they came to our base. The CIA has its own base, and they came up there. We have an airstrip and actually a great place to spend a few months. So the first week was ground school, lots of PT and running and jumping out of towers and learning PLF, parachute landing falls. The second week is when you make your jumps. And, you know, the parachute was called the MC-1-1 Bravo, and you jump out at 1,200 feet, and it's on a static line, and you come down pretty fast.
There were some compound fractures on that landing you were on.
There were. So on my third jump, we actually jumped out the back of a Chinook helicopter, which was easier than the first two jumps, where we jumped out of a Twin Otter, which is a short takeoff and landing plane, but you sit in the doorway and you're squeezed in with two others, and it's kind of tricky to jump out of there. So jumping out the back of a Chinook was actually quite easy. It was like jumping down a giant drain. But there was no wind to turn into, and when you're using that old parachute, you want to turn into the wind your final 100 feet or so to try and slow your descent. But there was no wind, so a lot of us got hurt on that jump, including somebody whose bone I recall sticking out of his leg.
Well, ambulances were waiting.
They were. In fact, my first jump, the ambulance was parked on the X where we were supposed to land, and so at the last minute I turned and ran with the wind to avoid landing on the ambulance.
Favorite chapter, favorite story from your book?
Oh, that's a tough one. I like them all. Well, there's one called CIA Safe Sex Practices, and that's just purely for, it's all true, but it's humorous as well. And as I state up front, it's not about birth control. It's about actually having sex on a safe. And then it gets into some adventures that took place during 2 weeks of demolition training we had at another secret base. And I think the story is, I'd rather not tell the whole story here because, you know, I don't want to spoil the punchline.
But people have to buy the book.
That's right. They've got to buy the book.
So again, American Spy. Where would somebody find the book?
Amazon. It's on, you know, you can get an audio version. It's Barnes & Noble, pretty much anywhere.
So you did the audio book?
No, somebody from Amazon named Chris, I can't remember his name now, Christopher Lane, I believe, did the book, and he did a very nice job with it.
That's a tough one, huh? Because he has to almost read into your mind, inflection and whatnot.
Right. And Amazon has been doing this, and they allowed me to choose which narrator I thought would be best. And he had done Charlie Wilson's War, and so he really did a fantastic job, much better than I would have done.
That's another story. And our friend, the Rand Scholar, had much admiration for Charlie Wilson. And what a tragic story. Was that at your time?
It was, although I wasn't involved. I have a good friend, in fact, in the book, he's called RJ. He was in Pakistan, and he was very much involved with the real Charlie Wilson's War, and he confirmed that the movie was right on target.
So, well worth reviewing.
Yes, indeed.
H.K. Roy, thank you for coming out of the dark and talking to us about your life and career in the CIA.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from KCBX Studios in San Luis Obispo, California, where we've been visiting with H.K. Roy, the author of American Spy.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. We'll be right back.